This free program is paid for by the listeners of WBAI New York. If you're not already a member, think about joining us to help keep free speech alive. This free program is paid for by the listeners of WBAI New York. If you're not already a member, think about joining us to help keep free speech alive.
And then you go on into some action.
Once upon a time when we were colored, stolen from the mother. 400 years later, Mr. Charlie's on some other. Take this as an affirmative act to slap back the whack. Catch brothers, sisters who are falling through the cracks. Creativity and unity, the keys to maintain our humanity and our sanity. No vanity, materialism, big willy crap. Just progressive elevation, can I get a soul clap? Keep it going on. CUC, keep it going on. Keep it going on. Creative unity, keep it going on.
The aliens are coming in 2010. They live down the hall from you. They push and shove you on the train. They look back at you in the mirror. We are all aliens in our own world. We have exciting news here at WBAI. Radio plays are rarely produced in the United States. So rare that there has only been a few done in the last 40 years. WBAI brings to you a new drama series, The Aliens.
You can still be a part of it. We are looking for sound designers and bands. Fans, send your albums to WBAI, Attention Aliens, 120 Wall Street, 10th floor, New York City, 10005.
For more information, check out our website, thealiens.moonfruit.com, and you can follow one of our characters right now on Twitter. Twitter name, Alien Drifter. The aliens are coming in 2010. They live down the hall from you. They push and shove you on the train. They look back at you in the mirror. We are all aliens in our own world. We have exciting news here at WBAI. Radio plays are rarely produced in the United States. So rare that there has only been a few done in the last 40 years. WBAI brings to you a new drama series, The Aliens.
You can still be a part of it. We are looking for sound designers and bands. Fans, send your albums to WBAI, Attention Aliens, 120 Wall Street, 10th floor, New York City, 10005.
For more information, check out our website, thealiens.moonfruit.com, and you can follow one of our characters right now on Twitter. Twitter name, Alien Drifter.
On Thursday night at 8 p.m., we honor those who fought for justice and equality and are now languishing in the dungeons of America's prisons.
We bring news of the continuing struggles for Puerto Rican independence, black liberation, anti-imperialism, and a world that favors life over profit and peace over war.
We stand with the mothers whose children have fallen at the hands of the police.
And we encourage and inform about the fightbacks because we know that another world is possible.
Where we live.
I'm Sally O'Brien.
And I'm Dequi Keone Siddiqui, inviting you to join us every Thursday night, 8 to 9 p.m.
Where we live. On listener-sponsored, non-commercial WBAI, 99.5 FM, New York.
And that's where you're tuned to, 99.5 FM WBAI, and we're available on the web at WBAI.org. WBAI, an instrument for community building. I think I like that.
By the way, our new phone number, which doesn't quite work yet and probably won't for months,
279-3400, area code
212-70.
That won't make it.
80.
God won't take it.
90.
That's close. 99 and a half
is almost.
But get you 100.
99.
Just won't. Oh, it just won't do.
The program you have just heard constitutes a little gentle nose-thumbing at ourselves and our profession, along with some things we sincerely felt have too long been departed from the airwaves or too rarely heard. It'll also serve as a little foretaste of some things to come on WBAI-FM, we hope. You're tuned to Hi-Fi, WBAI 99.5 on your FM dial, New York.
The American people desire and are determined to work for peace on earth, a just and lasting peace based on genuine agreement freely arrived at by equals. In the pursuit of these aims, the United States and other like-minded nations find themselves directly opposed by a regime with contrary aims and a totally different concept of life. That regime adheres to a false philosophy. That false philosophy is communism.
You're tuned to listener-sponsored radio, KPFA in Berkeley.
This is KPFK in Los Angeles.
And you're listening to WBAI in New York. In Houston, this is listener-sponsored KPFT.
WPFW in Washington.
What was amazing at the height of the McCarthy era was the notion of such a station existing anywhere.
Time passed. Many romantic feelings were associated with radio broadcasting, as with aviation or with motoring across the far western United States. Such memories have a certain literary appeal, no doubt, but they are also authentic.
Today we plan to look at Pacifica 50 years, to look at some of the high points and low points for Pacifica being on the air in 1949 from Berkeley under the leadership of Lou Hill, one of the most intriguing characters about which you could read in any area of work.
Listener sponsorship, of course, is an effort to complete the integration of this medium with the community of which it is part.
Pacifica Radio was the brainchild of Lewis Hill, a pacifist and poet. Hill and four others incorporated the Pacifica Foundation in 1946 and put KPFA on the air in 1949. KPFA represented a radical model for a nonprofit community-based radio station operating outside the parameters of mainstream broadcasting. Hill concluded that only a non-commercial broadcasting system financed by listener sponsorship could be free of commercial and governmental strictures.
The listener sponsorship experiment pioneered here has become the model for a good many like efforts around the country, in television as well as radio.
Lewis Hill was a man who believed very much in the importance and necessity of struggle at the spiritual level. So much so that we have often had arguments about it. However, he was at the same time a pacifist and a poet and a great humanist.
The fundamental philosophy of Pacifica was to establish an institution which would, in essence, bring people together who seemed to have a basic worldview, at least as best as I can tell from reading some of the old documents.
People who started the Pacifica Foundation were, for the most part, pacifists who had grown up in the pacifist student movement of the 1930s. Lewis Hill, Roy Finch, various people who were associated with the early Pacifica movement. Many of them were associated with the War Resisters League, the Fellowship of Reconciliation.
That we are bound together in our desire to see the world become a place in which our children can grow free and strong. We are bound together by the task that stands before us and the road that lies ahead. We are bound and we are bound.
Afternoon, that the brotherhood of man will become a reality in this day. With this faith, I will go out, carve the tunnel of hope through the mountain of despair. With this faith, I will go out with you and transform dark yesterdays into bright tomorrows. With this faith, we will be able to achieve this new day when all of God's children, black men and white men, Jews and Gentiles, Protestants and Catholics, will be able to join hands and sing with the Negroes in the spiritual of all, free at last, free at last. Thank God for it. God didn't call America to do what she's doing in the world now. God didn't call America to engage in a senseless, unjust war as the war in Vietnam. And we are criminals in that war. We've committed more war crimes almost than any nation in the world.
Good afternoon. I'm Earl Caldwell in studio here with Michael G. Haskins and Kathy Davis, the Director of Public Affairs here at WBAI. And in this special day, this special broadcast, and this most important celebration for us here at WBAI, 50 years of being here, it is so appropriate that this broadcast, that this segment of this day-long celebration begin with the voice and the words of Martin Luther King Jr. In the speech that he was just making, he was talking about the great movement against the war in the 60s in Southeast Asia. And when you listen to the words of Martin Luther King Jr., and you think back over those 50 years of WBAI being here, more than anything else, you could say that's what this station has stood for. Standing with these movements, these people's movements, the civil rights movement, the union movement, the anti-war movement, standing against these unpopular causes, police brutality. Probably no station has been more in the forefront of these fights for social justice. And so we come to this anniversary, and people say, well, you're tooting your own horn. It's not tooting your own horn. What it is doing is recognizing that we have a mission, and that mission has been to stand with people and the people's movements, and no matter where they are. Kathy has been very much involved in health issues and issues involving kinds of treatments and things that that are part of people's movements in medicine. And so she could speak to those kinds of things. I've been a reporter involved in what we would call the major media. Probably it's a misnomer. It's the dominant media, but it's not the major media, because it's the corporate media, and it's very limited in what it can do. And a part of the reason that I am at these microphones is because when I was shut down in that media, this door was open. And bring those stories here and feel that you have an opportunity here to represent all of those people that are shut out. In one particular case I'm thinking about involved police brutality in all of these major newspapers, the New York Times, the Daily News, the Newsday on Long Island. All of the papers had the story, but they stood, they kept it, they sat on it, and they said, oh no, we don't want to go there. We don't want to rock this boat. We're talking about citizens who do what we ask citizens to do. You've been wronged. You've been wronged by the police. We have a structure for that. It's called the Civilian Review Board. So bring your issues to the review board and you will get your hearing. But they were locked out. They were locked out until WBAI came to in and involved itself and said, no, here you're not locked out. Here we stand for the social justice. Here we are not afraid to take on the cause of that's unpopular, or the cause of that's being frowned on. I'm thinking this morning of 9/11. I came to the station 10 years ago, and it was at that time of 9/11, and we were all worried, concerned. What is happening? What's going on? What does this mean? How did this happen? But there was one huge side of this issue, all these huge questions. People would whisper them. There was a blackout on them until some young people who were daring enough to make a film called Loose Change that really began to explore some of these issues and questions. Only WBAI, only here was this information shared with the audience, and it was a tremendous response because people wanted to know. And it's to bring it full circle, every movement needs media. It needs media to survive, to grow, to have the chance to reach its potential, its destiny. And that's where WBAI has stood through these 50 years, with people, with the movements. And Michael G. Haskins, who was with me on my broadcast, the Caldwell Chronicle, and I've gotten to know Michael well in these 10 years, and his background is the same, standing with these people's movements and being having an ear tuned to those voices.
And, you know, Earl, I must say that the fact that I have been had the privilege to be here with some of the people that you have heard over these airwaves over this past day, and some of the people that you listen to regularly. I have learned from so many, many people who have come before me. And so I am tuned into these things because of the individuals that have come before me, the individuals that are here now. I have learned and I have grown with all of the people that are part of this radio station, and we come together this day as kind of a kickoff to a full year of celebrating the birth of WBAI and the continued growth, we certainly do hope and believe, of this radio station as we're moving forward. We are very, very grateful to, as I heard earlier in the previous segment, to the listeners of this broadcast, because they drive everything, because it would have no meaning if we were just here talking to ourselves. But 50 years later, we see that we do have relevance because people like a Governor Rockefeller did support the idea of this radio station, and all of the people who have gone on to support us over 50 years when they did not have to. They could have been directed to do other things, but they are have been here with us. And, you know, as we move on throughout this hour, I just wanted to throw it back to you, Earl. Even before you came here as that 10 years ago, I remember you were here during the 1990s in spots with Clayton Riley and Utrice Lee doing commentaries. What was this radio station? How did you feel its relevance, or did you feel its relevance during that period of time before you arrived here and before you became a permanent broadcaster, when you had your column in the Daily News and when you were writing regularly for the New York Times?
Thank you, Michael G. When I was at the Daily News in my column, you know, I was on over here at WBAI often. Samora reached out to me and brought me into various discussions that were going on and other issues where I would be reporting on the front end. I can recall when they had the child murders in Atlanta and people were wondering what's going on, what does this mean? And I was there for for months. I was there and covered the trial and covered a lot of the killings when they were happening. And WBAI locked into me there and used my reporting down there. And then the full circle is whenever I left the Daily News, when they refused to, when they said, if you're going to fight for information that we're saying is not going to go out, then you're not going to be here. WBAI not only reached out to me, but we were, at that time, over in the Union Hall, 1199 Union Hall, the union that Martin Luther King Jr. identified so much with. WBAI had I had those forums there, and I can recall vividly being invited. I had my book Black American Witness, and I was able to pay the rent by selling the books over at these forums. But those forums drew huge community crowds. And my point is, all along the line, this station has connected with the people, the grassroots efforts of people to organize, to come together, to give voice and momentum to issues that we fight through so much of our lives. We have in studio with us now Muriel Tillinghast, who comes to WBAI Pacifica from a background of being one of those persons who was on the line in what I consider to be the greatest mass movement in the history of this country, a movement that's changed it so profoundly. But when she was young and fearless and was one of those persons that we counted on to be on the front line, and she could speak to what it means to have the importance of media and where you get locked out and there's not a lot of places to go, but where you can go. So it's just really a thrill to have her here at the station now, and also for her to join us this morning on the broadcast.
Thank you.
Good morning.
Good afternoon.
It's morning for me, but yes, no good problem. Afternoon. Yes.
Yeah, I was interested in participating in this because I think that when we look at the year 2010, people tend to forget what it was like in 1960-61. I came out of Washington, D.C., which actually was a town that had a lot of sense of media blanket. And by that, I mean the suffocation of grassroots information coming to the fore. It was a town where people did not even want to mention J. Edgar Hoover's name publicly. If you went into a place and said, "Good morning, how you doing?" people gave you a subdued response. When you said, "Well, what do you think about that thing that was in the Washington Post the other day about J. Edgar Hoover?" everybody would find something else to focus on. So when I went south, and I had been active working in the civil rights movement in Washington, D.C., on various things, including the desegregation of public accommodations, as well as employment issues. I will say to you that when we entered into the south, it was very much like we used to call it behind the cotton curtain, because people did not realize, and they spent a lot of time talking about what was going on in other parts of the world where people had made major changes in their government. But we had as much of a blackout, or maybe more of a blackout, of media information in this country. I will tell you, in Mississippi, for example, if there was something on the television that those people did not want to see, the plug was pulled immediately. Mm. I don't know what they substituted. It could have been anything from cartoons to a person talking in the station, but they very much limited the scope and the content of information, and there was no information on black people's suffering. And there were other people who were suffering, Native Americans, Asians down there, but everybody had a different kind of prescription in terms of how they were going to struggle in the Deep South. And when it became, and I would just say this too, in Washington, D.C. as well, when you came up with information that was not flattering to the powers that be, there were very few media places that you could even approach, much less their ability to get that information out into the public airways. And so a place like WBAI became like a diamond, because that was a location where if you could get the news to them, they would put it out there. I'm reminding people of the Guardian newspaper that went under, which was another print media source that would get information out. And I can remember James Forman saying very clearly, "You got to get it to New York." You got it. You know, and through telephone relay systems, because, you know, our telephone lines would get pulled. You know, I'm very serious that, you know, it was in many ways a very active warfare going on with us. We weren't armed, but we were certainly pursued and handled as if we were people who were coming in with some extraordinarily different and alien concepts, like freedom and democracy and the ability to vote and all those kinds of really strange ideas, which a lot of people gave credence to only people who read manifestos not to people who could read constitutions.
Right.
So, mm-hmm.
And, you know, before we move on, or as we move on to some other things that it's 25 after, and this time, I assure you, as we all know, will go by just like that, I want to just play a piece of tape for all of us here in the studio and you out there listening at 99.5 FM, or if you're listening online at WBAI.org, listen to this piece of material, and then let's come back and talk a little bit about how that affected each one of us here in terms of our consciousness and where we were at the time, and how that propelled us forward, if it did.
Folks, listen to this story. It's one the world should know, of a Negro boy, 14, named Emmett Till. From Chicago to Mississippi to see his Uncle Mose, but we won't see little Emmett anymore. Emmett Till, Emmett Till. His name will be a legend we all know. Tallahatchie, Mississippi, to see his Uncle Mose, but we won't see little Emmett anymore. When younger he had polio, his mother's only child. She loved him as any mother would. His daddy wore the khaki, fought bravely for Uncle Sam, that his son might have the privilege that he should. A few days in Tallahatchie, Emmett with his little pals, to Money, Mississippi, grocery store to buy. They bought bubble gum and candy from the woman at the store. As they turned to leave, little Emmett said goodbye. His little pal said to him, "What you mean saying goodbye to the woman in Money grocery store?" They said, "She is good looking." Emmett said, "You're right." And that remark cost Emmett Till his life. Emmett Till, Emmett Till.
Yes, thank you, Michael, for that piece. I think this was one of those events that really electrified people in understanding how important it was to stand up and do something about the segregation and the oppression in the South of this country. And in light of that, Muriel Tillinghast, I wanted to ask you to give our listeners some sense of, you know, SNCC, the nonviolent student movements, and how that was electrified and what it was that you and your comrades did at that time.
Thank you. I was a student at Howard University. This was the winter of 1961. I was, in fact, minding my business. I like to say that. I was minding my business one Sunday afternoon when a friend of mine said, I'm going to a meeting. And I said, "Very good, and have a nice time." And she said, "No, you need to come with me." And I said, "Well, where are you going?" She said, "Well, you just come on." And we walked across Howard's campus, and we went to a place called the Emmaus House. I don't know whether you will remember that the religious organizations used to keep a chaplain and used to keep an open chaplaincy, actually, a house that was supported by their particular denominations on almost every major college campus. And in any case, the Emmaus House was run, I believe, by the Episcopal Church. And I walked in that door, and I saw easily 200 students sitting in every conceivable location, many of them white. The leadership of the organization, I think I walked in and Carmichael was talking. It was awe-inspiring. It changed my life. Anyway, he said to me, we're going to have a demonstration tomorrow at the Justice Department. And I said, "Well, that's wonderful." He says, "No, but you're in charge of communications." And I said, "How can I be in charge of communications? I don't know anything about what you're doing." He said, "Oh, well, you will by tomorrow at 6 o'clock. And that evening and all through the night, he proctored me on what to do, who to call, how to identify this demonstration, one of many. And my first call was to John Doerr, who was the head of the Civil Rights Division at the Justice Department. Anyway, to make a long story short, I found out that the Nonviolent Action Group was an affiliate chapter of a new group called the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee that was beginning its operations throughout the South. There had been sit-ins that were very spontaneous. There was an effort to pull the students together and put them in an organization. Ella Baker was one of the people who was, I guess you could say, had primacy in terms of doing that. She had worked with Martin Luther King. Martin had wanted the students to come under the SCLC umbrella, but Ella felt like the ministers would stifle the students' originality and spontaneity. And so in April, I believe it was April 15th, but don't hold me to the date, up at Shaw University in Greensboro, there was a call all around the South, all around the country, for students to come. And we used to call it the call. And people, you had a telephone tree. You were responsible for calling 10 people. People would show up. Those who were committed would show. Those who were not, obviously, wouldn't. And in any case, SNCC was formulating its operations in the South, and we were doing ours basically in what we would call the northern locations. And people joined around the idea of doing something. So it wasn't joining just an organization. There were core people who were doing the public accommodations, who were doing the freedom rides. There were people who were doing voter registration. There were people doing sit-ins on public accommodations. And all of them kind of came together and under this umbrella formed the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee. And the thing that made SNCC so very different is, first of all, because we were young and some people would say crazy, we went into areas that nobody else would go. There was a young man by the name of Robert Moses who, with a band of about 8 people, was headquartered in Macomb, Mississippi, which was a tough town in Mississippi, and they had been bombed on any number of occasions, and the decision had to be made somewhere in 63 in terms of whether or not the Mississippi Project was going to continue, and if it continued, how, or whether they were going to pull out of Mississippi because they were going to get hurt, slaughtered, and there were local Mississippians who were being killed, whose names you will not know, but who are in the annals of the Justice Department Civil Rights Division. To make a long story short, the decision was made to make a national call for the summer of 64, basically asking Northern students to come and to provide a shield, a political shield, to allow local blacks in Mississippi to begin to activate with basically a shield of white Northern students to slow up the response of the local vigilantes, which were very active in Mississippi. People think that the Klan was the only organization. There were about 16 or 20 organizations, and the Klan was probably the most liberal of all of the organizations. I remember one that was called the Association for the Preservation of White Race. That was just one of a number of hybrid groups running around that felt that the Klan wasn't killing enough people, they needed to kill more. Make a long story short, so we went south. The 4 civil rights groups were called together, some of them kicking and screaming. It was the NAACP, CORE, SNCC, and the 4th one is escaping my mind. But nonetheless, they formed an organization called the Council of Federated Organizations, headquartered in Jackson, Mississippi. And in that organization, the state was divided into districts. I worked in a SNCC area, but my most contiguous area was in CORE. So I worked a lot with CORE people. And in fact, when I finally left my river counties and came into Jackson to run the state operations, It was a core guy who came and kept me alive because we were living on $9.64 a week. That was also paying rent. And we didn't have much for food, and he would come by every 2 weeks to make sure that we were still standing up.
Wow.
Me and a girl named Marianne Shapanko. And if Marianne, if you're out there, you know, you need to be in touch with me at WBAI. And she and I ran the state operation back to back after people left after the summer of 64. So that's it in a nutshell.
Well, that's clearly indication that we have to revisit this story. I wanted to thank you for coming in off the cuff, Muriel, and joining us for that explanation. And Earl, I know you want to follow up.
I want to ask you one quick question. You were playing this piece about Emmett Till. Mm-hmm. And all that Emmett Till thing is just terrifying to think what happens to this child. And then here you guys are leaving your college educations, leaving the campus, and going right into the face of, I mean, terrifying a situation. Mm-hmm. But what was it that was pulling you to put everything on hold to do this?
Well, I think in a nutshell, it was something that had to be done. That every generation had, for one reason or another, well, no, let me go back and correct that. Generations had made whatever strides they felt they could make, but the state of Mississippi has historically been the backbone of not only segregation. Segregation has a lot of tentacles, which including vigilantism, just the wanton physical oppression of black people on top of economic oppression, et cetera. I can tell you people who work 60 hours a week who made $15. Mm. So I'm just saying that, you know, when Bob Moses went into Mississippi and worked with local Mississippians, there needed to be a bigger idea and a bigger vision besides sort of having a beachhead.
Right.
Because the beachhead wasn't working very well, frankly.
Mm.
And I will say to you that whatever bravery we had was certainly matched by the bravery of local Mississippians.
Mm-hmm.
when I did the state operation, part of my job was to call every project area at least twice a day. And I will tell you, I used to call that the death call.
Wow.
Because every day I was taking down names of people who had either disappeared or who were killed. Some of these people were not even associated with us directly. But, I mean, every day 20, 30, 40 people easily. And some of them were children.
Mm.
Some of them were old people. But the state has always prided itself in keeping its black folks in their place, whatever place they thought that was. So that's it in a nutshell.
Wow. That's amazing. The voice of Muriel Tillinghast and recounting what it was. And who, as Earl ask her that question, the heroes, the sheroes of that particular time, as my father would say to me often, giving appropriate recognition to the James Foremans and Martin Luther King Jr.'s and so on, but the people like Muriel and the people in Mississippi who lived there were the real heroes because they had to face this every single day, and they didn't live in Washington or New York or Chicago. They lived right there, the true heroes.
Exactly, and I just want to thank you, Muriel Tillinghast, because I think you're certainly one of those heroes from that time, and I appreciate that you shared with us how important media like WVAI was to that struggle. And speaking of BAI and struggles around the world, we're going to play for you a little piece of a program produced by Samori Marksman in which he speaks about Nigeria, South Africa, Liberia, and gives some sense of what's happening in the world. And this is also a very important piece of the WBAI historical broadcast.
Oh, yes.
First, just sharing the work of Samori Marksman, which certainly is one of my heroes here at WBAI, but his strong commitment to liberation struggles around the world, Pan-Africanism,
absolutely,
and others, including the Caribbean. So we'll play a little bit of this so you can get a sense of the kind of broadcast that you would have heard on WBAI.
Who is the black?
And this is WBAI in New York City, non-commercial, listener-sponsored Pacifica Radio Broadcasting at 99.5 FM on
Monday, the 27th of December, 1993, the last Monday, in fact, of 1993, and continuing our program now, we turn to another part of the world, and we will be featuring a segment on Nigeria. Some interesting proposals are being made, and we hope that we might be able to maybe gain a keener sense as to what's unfolding in Nigeria. Reporting on developments related to Libya and South Africa, as you said, connecting both countries. South Africa said on Monday, a British newspaper report alleging that it had agreed to supply Libya with weapons in return for oil was false and part of a plot to undermine its new democracy. Neither President Nelson Mandela nor the South African government and its agencies have entered into any discussions, let alone concluded any deals with Libya on arms for oil. That was said by a government spokesperson in South Africa. Britain's Southern Sunday Telegraph said South Africa had agreed to a secret $500 million deal to supply Libya with weapons and spare parts for its aging Mirage jet fighter and attack helicopters in return for cut-price oil. What is utterly disgusting about this article is that it is a pure fabrication invented by the newspaper and its unnamed sources, the statement said. Those who elected to peddle these untruths are either part of a massive disinformation campaign against our new democracy, or they have allowed themselves to be used in such a campaign. The newspaper said the deal was negotiated by South African Secret Service officials and approved by Mandela, who has irked Washington by retaining his friendship with Libyan leader Muammar Gaddafi, a staunch opponent of the old apartheid regime. Any such agreement would violate UN sanctions imposed on Libya for its reluctance to hand over two men suspected of a 1988 bombing of a U.S. airliner over Lockerbie in Scotland, in which 270 persons died. The Organization of African Unity agreed at a summit earlier this month that African countries would ignore the sanctions, criticizing Britain and the United States for refusing to deal under which the suspects would be tried in a third country. South Africa abides by decisions of the United Nations on the issue of Libya, the government said. At the same time, we are part of the resolutions of the OAU on how this matter should be resolved. And that item coming from South Africa, a very touching situation evolving in the Horn of Africa, something we've touched on before and will continue to as the situation deteriorates in many ways. A report from the Horn of Africa, Ethiopian Prime Minister Meles Zenawi said on Tuesday his government would teach Eritrea a lesson if it failed to withdraw from Ethiopian territory. Meles told Reuters he was prepared to, quote, go the extra mile for mediation in the conflict between the Horn of Africa neighbors, but he said the Ethiopian government was also preparing for war. What we will try to do if they don't withdraw is to ensure their invading army is removed from our territory and make sure the lesson will have been learned, Meles said. Meles stressed that Ethiopia had no territorial claims on Eritrea and no intention of interfering domestically with the government of Eritrea and President Isaias Afwerki. Our target is to reverse the invasion. The political objective is to make use of the invasion so the invasion does not take place again. That is the attempt to invade Ethiopia again. In an apparent attempt to seize the moral high ground, Meles said Ethiopia would make an extra effort for mediation and would refrain from bombing civilian targets or seizing Eritrean territory in case of war. We have no intention of occupying any piece of real estate in Eritrea, he said. The two allies have been at loggerheads since May 6, when a border dispute degenerated into clashes in which hundreds have been killed. There have been no reports for nearly 2 weeks of major fighting on the original front in Badwe or Zale Bambesa or a third front south of the Eritrean port of Asab.
And that's just a small piece of Samori Marksman and the brilliance of Samori. And we used to work very, very closely, Kathy, you and I, with Samori. I did worked with him on Behind the News the last, I believe, year and a half of Samori's life. And he was a very dedicated mentor to many of us.
That's right. I actually started producing during that time, and I have enormous respect, and I often work with him on the other side in terms of fundraising, actually. I learned a lot about programming and about the meaning of the work here at WBAI from Samori Marksman. And I just wanted to say, for people who are supporting this program, it would be really helpful if you were to go to our website, WBAI.org. You can make a donation to WBAI, help support the work as we move forward into our next, I would say 50 years, but I want to say 500 years.
I just wanted to add that in listening to Samori and this large vision that he carried, so much of the time we're consumed with our very local issues, and we don't realize that we are a part of a larger world global movement. Not long after I came to WBAI and I was carrying credentials from WBAI, I was invited to a reception at the Secretary General's residence at the United Nations, Secretary General then being Kofi Annan, an African. And I was there, and I got there. I was really taken aback because all of the network news anchors were there. Truly, it was the heavyweights of the media in the United States there. And one by one, they were greeting the Secretary General, and so-and-so from network. And so I'm standing on my line, and I was sort of thinking to myself, well, he'll have no idea who we are, so I have to explain it to him. So I came my turn. I said, well, I'm Earl Caldwell from WBAI Radio in New York, and then I began to try to explain what WBAI was, and the Secretary General put up his hand, and he stopped me, and he said, you don't have to explain. He said, I know WBAI. He said, I know about the work that Pacifica does, and he embraced me, and it was a stunning moment. But what it drove home was that this station, sometimes people wonder, what can one station do? What can one voice do? What? And it tells you the impact that you can have. And it's so, and the impact is so dramatic because we don't have a lot of WBAI. We don't have a lot of this people's radio, the radio that will reach out, the radio that does stand for these things and has made this commitment that year after year through this whole half a century stands by that. So sometimes, you know, we don't realize the reach of one station, but it's all of this programming, bringing all of these issues from South Africa, from Samori's talking about the Horn of Africa, across the continent, bringing it to the readers, to the listeners here, and it has an impact, and they are very much aware that we're here and what we're doing.
You know, because Samori certainly embodied the term internationalist, because he would regularly, every week, be talking with individuals such as Tony Benn or Dilla Piro, Desmond Tutu, and Gore Vidal, just to name a few of the people that would be on his broadcast every single time. And he, more than anybody else within Pacifica, I do believe, help shape, I wouldn't say only, because we are all a collective, an amalgam of each other, shaped the programming that was to come in the later half of the 1990s. And another individual that was very instrumental in terms of my, I'll speak for you here as well, Kathy, our understanding of world issues, and as far as Black people's place in this world, was Ilambe Brass.
Exactly. Yeah. I felt like he certainly educated me, and I think many, many people who listen to WBAI. And, I think that we would be remiss to have a program and not have included both Samori and Ilambe Brass as the real pillars of insight and knowledge and expansion of thinking here at WBAI. And we're going to be playing a piece. It's Ilambe Brass in a public talk, but was one of our broadcasts We've broadcast several times, and he is speaking in a program called The Black Artist and Liberation Struggles, in which he really goes into some of the struggles here in the United States and the role that artists, musicians have played in that struggle. So let's hear some of that.
Again, apologies on behalf of the New York chapter of the National Conference of Artists and the Pan-African Professional Photographic Society, which is giving this particular seminar. This is the third week of a show that started on the 1st of June and will last until the end of June. In between that time, there were four weeks of panels. Previously, there was Black Women in the Arts and also Where Do Our Clothes Come From and the Fine Art of Spinning. And that was like last week. Today, which seems to be the pinnacle and the high point, we're to listen to presentations based on the musician's role in the liberation struggle. And as Kwame has pointed out, the various people who are here, we intend to do that. Later on this afternoon at 2 o'clock, there'll be an extension of that, the role of the artists in the liberation struggle. And we will talk about the people who are going to be there. I'll let you know now, Adamola Olegabafola, who's an artist, who was one of the leading cadre in the movement to coordinate the presentation of black art, plastic art, paintings and sculpture with the struggle that was going on in the 60s. Abdul Rahman, who another person who was famous for his African surrealism, almost a painter in the style, only equivalent, I guess you could say, that maybe in the general world of painting would be like what Salvador Dali was doing, but coming from an Islamic position, he'll be here this afternoon. Dr. Rosalind Jeffries, who is a professor who deals with African art and the history of African art, and she'll be here this afternoon. And, of course, she's the wife of Dr. Leonard Jeffries, so you have two PhDs in one family that have been contributing to the struggle of our people. And then Meg Henson-Scales will also be here this afternoon. And the moderator is Amiri Baraka, most people would know. Just before bringing on the first presenter, as this contribution towards the Black Music Month, which is going on now, I guess it's 1979, is a very, very important month. Because just as we have African Liberation Month, we have different things, African History Month. The importance of African music is something that is unparalleled when you start to look at all the other things that the Black people have contributed. Because African music is one of the most universal phenomena. It is something that is interchangeable with various parts of the African world. And it has cross-fertilization with various other parts of at the African world. You'll find that if you talk to Bob Marley, he'll tell you about the impact of, say, what rhythm and blues did to the people in Jamaica, how they contributed to that. You can see how, James Brown impacted on Fela, Lafi, Kute. And he will tell you about how that's been impacting. We can see, we start to talk about South Africa, how much the struggle in the United States, particularly around bebop and everything that came out of an industrial, area, a place where working class, I think, that the two societies develop very similar, and you'll find a lot of people down in South Africa playing like Fats Navarro and Charlie Parker and stuff, going way back, And of course, when you start to go to South and Central America, you can find the impact of Black music all the way from, of course, Cuba, which everybody knows, particularly because of, Mercedes Valdez and Celia Cruz. And of course, when you start to go even to Peru, which is recently impacted on the Black community when Susana Baca, Lucia Campos and people like that who we play, on my show on Africa Kaleidoscope almost on a regular basis to try to show you how this thing goes together. But the point is that with the liberation struggle, because as Black music has come out of struggle, out of rebellion, out of way of trying to telegraph messages to other people who had been enslaved, and since they had taken away the language, from the African, or the African invented a new language.
A great to hear the voice of Alambe, because he is so many of these issues as he was speaking. My mind was just going through so many of these things that he's been a part of. Not just that he's closely identified in this station with the African issues, but these cultural issues. And he mentions Amari Baraka and this long line of very distinguished, talented, courageous people. I'm also thinking of Harry Belafonte and so many folks. You hate to start naming names because you miss names, but these microphones here, this outlet, this one little beacon has attracted so much through these five decades. And it has because people understand that it is here that you can mobilize people to change things in significant ways. In labor, in social justice issues, and issues involving our health, so many areas, WBAI has been on that forefront. Not because we say it, because the history says it so. And so to come to this moment today, not just to look to the past, but also to look to the future, because while we can and we ought to celebrate a great history, we have made a commitment, and we are already laying groundwork to be even more effective in what is to come, and that's what is exciting.
You're so right. You're so right. And I have to say that, of course, I think many of us who work here at WBAI came aboard as listeners, then volunteers, and then getting involved, getting drawn into the work of WBAI. And as you stated earlier, my involvement was primarily with regard to health. And I actually came in with the music, listening to Shocking Blue with Delphine Blue. But the next program that completely caught my attention was Natural Living with Gary Null.
Yes,
and the information that he provided on health was so important. And I feel that during the time when he was here, everybody who spoke like he did was called some kind of a health nut.
Yeah.
And he was like, he was really a revolutionary during that time. And he spoke to people in a way that educated so many of us
yes.
on what it meant to take care of our health. And he also inspired a lot of us to get involved in health activism, which I did, and became part of the struggle to protect the rights of alternative practitioners and our rights as individuals to have access to supplements and vitamins and the like. So and that
which
movement
is still under attack
today.
Yeah.
Right, with Codex Alimentarius. So the struggle of that still goes on, but I just wanted to give respect to where that started for me, and it was a consequence of what I heard here on WBAI.
Yeah.
And you know, as well, Alambe was the one who really helped me understand and put into context the movements of the African movements and Samori, the Pan-African, what the relationship was to me and what was happening in Africa.
Well, you know, we're just about out of time, but I do want to say that this is just the opening salvo. This entire day is the opening salvo to what we're going to be doing the entire year. All of 2010, we're going to be taking a look back as well as looking forward, because we're taking this radio station toward the next 50 years or toward the next 100 years through the help of listeners just like you. We're going to be bringing in different voices, people from our past, from our present, hopefully from our future as well, to be thanking us all and remembering how this station started, how this station developed and molded us all. So we're going to be absolutely doing this. We only have a few names of few of the people that were able to come to the radio station this very first day, but we're going to be doing more. We're going to be reaching out to other individuals that were integral parts of this radio station, WBAI.
That's true, and it's amazing as I've been going through all of the various audio components that, I mean, it's just utterly amazing, and I'm actually working on putting together a collection for our anniversary of historical broadcasts, some of which you heard today, and which will be available in our upcoming fund drive, by the way. Okay. Tune in for that and support WBAI. I want to thank for lunch today. It was provided by Subway Sandwich Shop at 122 Water Street, and the owner, Fethi Hasnow, and the owner of 122 Water Street, New York. Okay, and we want to thank you. We encourage our listenership to visit the store. And thank them for supporting WBAI.
And we'll go out with just another little short excerpt.
Before going, I want to thank Peter Beauchamp and his mixes for helping us throughout this day. Peter Beauchamp, all mixed up.
That when they talked about, you know, steal away to Jesus, they wouldn't just talk about steal away to Jesus because they just wanted to go to heaven. They were talking about the good ship Jesus that had brought in so many people here during slavery. They wanted to get back to that ship to return home. And if most often in black music at that time, it always was a body of water they talked about. Maybe it was across the Jordan, you know, but those waters always were to the slave, the Atlantic, and how they would get back to where they came from, you know. And as you start to look about how black music developed, you know, whether it's blues or field hollers or whatever, it comes out of the experience of African people, and it's something that ties them together. When you start to think about how, you know, the Jubilee and the Gospels and everything, the spiritual thing, where people try to use the music that was given to them to use as organizing tools.
On Tuesday, January 19th at 2 a.m., Sugar and My Bowl will feature saxophonist, flutist, oboist, composer, educator, and one of the NEA 2010 American Jazz Master recipients, Yusef Lateef. That's Tuesday, January 19th at 2 a.m., right here on WBAI New York, 99.5 FM.
Please remember that this program is supported by the listener members of WBAI New York. If you like what you hear, please consider becoming a member of WBAI or renewing if you've already joined. Basic membership is $25, but we accept any amount. Help us keep free speech alive. Please remember that this program is supported by the listener members of WBAI New York. If you like what you hear, please consider becoming a member of WBAI or renewing if you've already joined. Basic membership is $25, but we accept any amount. Help us keep free speech alive.